Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Cyber attacks are not new, but their density and audacity is rising. Sony boldly hit and robbed Lockheed Martin, a specialist in sophisticated weapons and security hit. Banks, car makers, power grids hit and probed. Sometimes it's almost funny. PBS hacked with a story saying Tupac Shakur is alive in New Zealand. But it's really deadly serious. The Pentagon now says cyber attacks can be acts of war. This hour, On Point, the latest on cyber attacks and cyber security. You can join the conversation. Will we hack our way to war? Has your company, your online world, been hit? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Alan Paller. He's research director for the SANS Institute for Computer Security Training. Alan Paller, thanks very much for being with us.
It's great to be here, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Scott Borg, director and chief economist at the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit, a nonprofit research institute that studies the strategic and economic consequences of cyber attacks. Scott Borg, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Great to be back.
I had not realized until this drumbeat of recent attacks came up and then the Pentagon started speaking. Then I looked back and really paid attention. Last month, the U.S., the White House put out a big new strategy paper talking about a global framework for, economic and military cybersecurity as big as that put out after the Second World War. What is raising concerns so high right now, Scott? This is not new. Cyber attacks have been around. What's going on that has pushed it up the agenda lists?
So we've got a couple of things going on. One is that the new attack tools are so much more sophisticated than what we were seeing a couple of years ago. They are almost impossible to detect by conventional means, by the means that we've been using in the past. Meanwhile, certain groups, in particular the Chinese, a number of different groups in China, have become much bolder about the use of these tools. So essentially, all our information is being sucked away.
Sucked away information like what? I mean, it's important enough that it's got the White House and the Pentagon up in arms. What kind of information?
So all of the information that allows businesses to create value, all of the information they need to carry out all of their business processes, all of the information they need to run their factories and production facilities, it's all being stolen.
What do you do with that? I mean, you take the information I use to run my factory. What's the value in that? You build a factory and do the same thing in China? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, or elsewhere in Southeast Asia. When you open a new factory, a new production facility, you typically can reduce your costs by 5 to 15% each year for the first 5 or 6 years. And that's where most of your profit comes.
Because of technological advances, process advances?
That's right. As you refine the running of things, as you learn how to readjust your valves, pressures, temperatures to more efficient levels. Now, it's now possible with cyber attacks to steal all that information, to steal the entire layout of your factory, the information on how everything is connected to everything else, and to actually steal all those settings for all those valves and switches so that a company in China or elsewhere in Southeast Asia can open a factory and on the day it opens have a level of efficiency that it took the American or European market leader 6 years to get to.
So, Scott, is that what people are talking about? I mean, here's Congressman Trent Franks, Republican, Arizona. They just had this big House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee meeting. He says, we face a menace today that may represent the gravest short-term threat to peace and security of the human family in the world today. Is he talking about industrial espionage?
To some degree, they are. They're also talking about the fact that most of our military secrets are leaking away. So what we've got is we've got a situation where all of the systems that depend on secrecy are in jeopardy. The systems that depend on electronic systems are potentially in jeopardy. And we have the prospect of not just theft of small things like credit card fraud. We have the prospect of entire industries being stolen. So this is a gigantic crisis on several fronts.
Family jewels being stolen there. Alan Paller, is the Pentagon, now they've got this new a report coming out saying that a cyber attack can be tantamount, can constitute, in fact, an act of war. Is that, in effect, an admission of failure, Alan? They can't stop these things, so they have to threaten, menace others from doing it? I mean, this military official was very prominently quoted saying, you know, shut down our power grid. We may put a missile down your smokestack. Is this using old-fashioned weapons to try and intimidate newfangled cyber attackers, Alan?
It is, in fact, attempting to deter attackers. Mm-hmm. The problem here is that the attackers have very low cost to do their attack, and because we're so completely dependent on electronics and the network, we're very vulnerable. So we can't economically buy our way out of this the way we did with other weapon systems. We have to set up deterrence, and one of the deterrents is to threaten to take action that might appear disproportionate, but the Pentagon's working on a theory called equivalency, which says if the attack you're doing causes the same kind of damage as a bomb, then that attack is the equivalent of a bomb.
Therefore, the United States would be justified in delivering a bomb on one of your facilities, whoever you may be.
That's what they're saying, yes.
Do you see that as an admission of failure on the cybersecurity front? I mean, if we could, you know, sew up and make safe our electronic realm, presumably we wouldn't be threatening that kind of chest-beating hardware response.
Scott was exactly right when he described the tools as being much more sophisticated and very difficult to stop. This is one of those things that if people are willing to spend enough money, they can get around the defenses. I think the business community saw that early last year when Google was hit, because they thought of Google as one of those great technological companies, and they thought to themselves, if Google can't protect themselves, who can? And then when they see Lockheed being hit, when they see the Pentagon being hit, they're feeling the reality that Scott was talking about, which is these attacks are sophisticated. It's an arms race. So each time we build a new defense, the attackers develop new techniques that go around those defenses. So we're in the middle of an arms race. It's not going to end in the near term. And putting up walls doesn't work well enough, so you want to have another kind of wall, and that's what this deterrent strategy of the Defense Department is. It's another type of wall.
Scott Borg, what do you make of this equivalency idea? Hurt us via cyber attack, and we may hurt you via actual, you know, hard weaponry. How does that work? You're describing a situation of sort of oceanic leaks all over the place. So what's the equivalent, military equivalent response to that? Is there one?
That's exactly right. Stealing information now can be just as destructive as seizing a military base, as seizing an aircraft carrier. And so the effects of this can be huge. I think describing this as something that is tantamount to acts of war is only being realistic. I think they are just articulating the new reality. But the problem with deterrence is that it is too easy to conceal where the attack is coming from. We can't figure out much of the time who has carried out an attack. When we do, it's usually by other kinds of intelligence, by other means. You can pick up a laptop or a smartphone for cash, or steal one or acquire one by some other means. You can walk into a hotel lobby or sit in the parking lot of a facility where there's free wireless, and you can launch your attack from there. And you can do that from anywhere in the world. There is no way to remove that anonymity. If an attacker wants to conceal their identity, they can conceal their identity.
So, Alan.
A couple of things. One is, I think, not publicly, but behind the scenes, we're getting much, much better at attribution. That's what Scott was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And we can. It is very difficult for the average person to figure out who's attacking them, but there are some extraordinary new tools that are much better at that. Not perfect, and Scott's right, but much better at that. But I wanted to point to a completely different use of the word equivalency. The theft of information may one day be thought of as equivalent to a bomb, but Pandora's box was opened a few months ago when you read about the Iranian attack on the centrifuges. Someone, no one knows exactly who, attacked via an electronic attack, attacked the centrifuges in Iran, causing them to be so damaged they had to be replaced. That when I say that, that opened
thereby
Pandora.
Setting back the Iranian nuclear program very substantially, and now we're complaining about these attacks. But and no one's confirming. But the word on the street is that that was Israel with American help, very likely.
A lot of people are guessing about who did it. It's hard to get a straight answer on exactly who was responsible. We do know, though, where the research was done. It was done at a place called Idaho National Labs. And when it was done, it wasn't aimed at centrifuges. It was testing whether or not power generation could be taken out remotely. And if you were to use exactly the same technique, no difference in techniques, but aim it at power generating plants, you could very comfortably destroy the generation capacity of multiple power generation units. And the U.S. has only about one or two in reserve. So if five or six were taken out, they would be out for months, perhaps years. So that's what we mean by the equivalency. We're not talking about just the theft of information. I would have trouble figuring out the equivalency on theft of data. But if you take out a power plant, that's the same as bombing it.
The House hearing this week was looking at the power grid, and the testimony there indicating that smart grids, which everybody is pushing for to be more efficient in the way we move our energy around, would actually be more vulnerable to this kind of cyber attack. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the latest wave of cyber attacks and the Pentagon's new finding that a cyber attack can be considered an act of war. Alan Paller is with us from the SANS Institute for Computer Security Training. Scott Borg is here. He's director and chief economist at the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit. On May 17th, just a couple of weeks ago, White House officials unveiled what they dubbed the International Strategy for Cyberspace. Here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at the press conference.
We have to build a global consensus around a shared vision for the future of cyberspace to make sure it serves rather than impedes the social, economic, and political aspirations of people worldwide. And that can only happen through patient, persistent, and creative diplomacy.
The Secretary of State in on this issue. You see the kind of scale that it's at now. Now the Pentagon in there, the White House in there, debate going back and forth with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce now about whether what the White House is proposing goes too far. Scott Borg, have you checked in on that? There, I thought the Chamber of Commerce was for this. You would think they would be if American corporations are losing their shirts and shorts too, maybe, in the way that you're describing, but now they're saying that there's too much government oversight imagined or in the White House plan.
So the problem here is that we have to do something, and we have to do it quite urgently. Yet there's not a consensus on how to go about it. And one of the problems is that we have a lot of people in the political world and in the business world who are still learning about how this subject works. So we have a lot of proposals that are on the right track, but are going to go wrong in the details and have unintended consequences. It's going to take a lot of public discussion to sort this out, which is actually why I'm so delighted to be talking with you and so delighted to have someone as distinguished as Alan Paller here on the program.
Well, Alan, the White House plan would require, the Wall Street Journal reporting here, certain companies running the most crucial infrastructure to submit to more rigorous outside oversight of their cybersecurity practices. I guess the U.S., the White House is saying, like you and Scott, look, this is a national security threat. We can't just leave it up to individual corporations. Does that seem reasonable to you, Alan, to have somebody sort of double-checking to make sure things are sewn up as well as they can be?
It does make sense for a sad reason. A lot of companies give lip service to security. They say, we have the best security and we have audits, but they don't actually do the detailed monitoring that it takes to ensure their systems are safe. And the Pentagon in particular, but all of America, is so dependent on both electricity and communications that at least those two industries can't just run off and guess whether or not their security is good enough. They really have failed to step up to the levels of security that are needed, particularly people like the Edison Electric Institute who are representing the power companies are saying they're doing the right thing, but when you go in and look at what they're doing, they're not.
And meanwhile, again, the journal reporting here, U.S. intelligence officers worried that cyber attackers could break into computer systems to crash subway trains, destroy nuclear reactors, disrupt financial markets. And the reporting, Scott Borg, that U.S. officials have already found cyber spies snooping around the nation's electric grid. This is kind of mind-boggling. I mean, we've migrated, what, a gigantic proportion of our economy and our lives to this electronic realm. Then we turn around and it looks sort of absolutely naked and utterly vulnerable.
Yes, that's right. There's no way a modern economy can function anymore without elaborate networks of computers. And yet with that comes probably an ongoing vulnerability, a vulnerability that we're not going to be able to do anything about very soon. I have a slight difference in emphasis here with Alan. It's hard to disagree with Alan because he speaks with such authority on these subjects. But I'm very wary of government mandates. I think we probably need some. But the problem is we don't have good solutions, good lasting solutions to these problems. And by the time the government decides on what to mandate, what to require these companies to do, and has actually begun to put that into effect, it's likely to be obsolete. And not only obsolete, but an actual impediment to introducing the security measures that by that time would be needed. So we don't really have a solution that we can just impose, no matter how much power we're willing to give the government.
Is there a fundamental technological problem here? Got lots of response here, and here's a web posting from Mad Mark the Code Warrior. This is just an hour ago or so, but anticipating our conversation, here's what he wrote. Let me put it to you. He said, maybe if corporate America had not drunk the PC Kool-Aid back in the late 80s and 90s and run full speed into the arms of Bill Gates, the security of our PCs, servers, and communications infrastructure would be built on a solid foundation rather than, he writes, the mix of bubblegum, Band-Aids, and naivete that filled the hearts and minds of the kids in Redmond and consumers who gobbled up their marketing. He writes, again, this is Mad Mark the Code Warrior. Now we have bots in our servers, PCs, phones, storage network devices. They're everywhere. We have screen door security because our society wanted to believe that cheap computing came without a big price. You get what you pay for. What do you say to that, Alan Peller?
That's a religious war between the PC, the people who love PCs, the people who hate PCs. But what I say to it is that much of the work right now that is being done to make the internet safer is actually looking at a solution that pulls the computing away from the PCs, that doesn't leave all the computing in the PCs and moves more toward a cloud environment or where the computing is done on servers that can be better protected, and your PCs are no longer PCs, they're just windows into the server. So in fact, without all the words around it, he may very well have been right that had we not gone so universally toward very powerful machines on our desktops, we might have had much more safety in our networks, but we would have had a phenomenally lower amount of innovation. So we would have paid too high a price, I think.
But Scott, your point is that innovation is being siphoned off. I mean, I don't know exactly at what rate. The way you put it almost sounds like siphoned off as fast as we come up with it. That doesn't seem like much of a payoff.
Yeah, the limitation on the use of all this stolen information is the lack of personnel to actually apply what's been stolen. They've stolen more information than they can possibly use. So this is a really huge problem. There's a terrible danger in this sort of situation when you're in a bad fix to just start blaming everybody.
Yeah.
And the big players like Microsoft are easy to blame. But the problem is really part of the information age. It's fundamental to the world we've moved into. We now have machines that are capable of receiving instructions. And the attack tools are instructions. And as long as we're using universal instructable machines, which are computers, we're going to have people finding ways to tell them to do things we don't want to do. It's part of the new era that we're in.
Well, is there an issue here with asymmetrical, I don't know what you call it, digital ethics? I mean, you're saying that China is doing tons and tons of this. You're suggesting that the U.S. is not, that it's not a two-way street. I'm looking at this new Pentagon, the Washington Post, reporting on the new Pentagon strategy and this framework. And it clarifies, quoting the Post here, for instance, that the military needs presidential, U.S. presidential authorization to penetrate a foreign computer network and leave a cyber virus that can be activated later. That would require White House sign-off. It says the military does not need such approval, however, to penetrate foreign networks for a variety of other activities, like studying the cyber capabilities of adversaries, examining how power plants or other networks operate. I mean, is everybody doing this? Is the U.S. just as vigorously poking around in China's computers as China is in ours, Scott?
So China's activity here is more extensive and has a different kind of motive. And the reason is this. China is a catch-up economy. Developed economies, like those of the United States and Western Europe, have an annual growth rate of between 2 and 4%, usually somewhere just below 3%.
We'd be thrilled for that right now, but yeah.
That's right. Countries like China have a growth rate of something like 10% or more. The reason they have such a high growth rate is not that they're smarter than we are or better organized or able to do things better. The reason they have such a high growth rate is they are copying all our technologies and large portions of our business practices.
But they're not stealing all of it. A lot of American corporations give it to them in order to have permission to go and do business in China.
So something relatively new has happened here. China, over the course of many years, was able to gradually copy technologies that were first kind of medium-level technologies like machine tooling and basic physical manufacturing, and then moving on to higher and higher technology levels. As they have done this, it's been harder with each stage for them to acquire the information they need by ordinary means. It used to be they could just go into factories and photograph everything and copy it. Now what they need is the information hidden in those control systems in those factories. There are only two ways they can get that information. One is to establish some kind of partnership relation and convince a Western company to just give them that information. The other way is to steal it by cyber attacks. And cyber attacks then become a very important part of their process, of their development strategy. In fact, you could say that cyber attacks are now part of the basic development model, the basic economic development model of China. This gives them a very different role than they have in the U.S.
Boy, at a time when we need every job and every advantage we can get our hands on, that doesn't sound too good. Scott, Alan, please stand by. Lots of listeners here. Dave in Beacon Falls, Connecticut. Dave, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, you know, just 7 miles from my house here, there are hundreds of People's Republic of China citizens working at that huge IBM facility that you can see from I-84. And, of course, you know, I have an Anglo-American friend and an Indian-American friend who are actually fearful of their jobs as cubicle by cubicle, they get replaced by L-1 visa employees from mainland China.
But a lot of Americans are working in Beijing now or, you know, Shanghai. Is it so different?
It's the numbers, and it's the numbers. And don't forget, we're in an era where I have a relative who wants to go to Rochester Institute of Technology, and he will definitely need a Pell Grant. And it looks like we're talking now to save the deficit to pay for the, you know, we're talking about getting rid of Pell Grants. We're talking about, and I hear some of the same conversations. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce says, oh, well, don't want to have too much regulation. We want to have innovation. Didn't they say that about credit default swaps? I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has just said, and the Republican Party, pretty much the same thing. They've just said now they want to have more high-tech workers to come into America. And at the same time, they're cutting Pell Grants. So my nephew, who wants to go to Rochester Institute of Technology, who has a passion for IT, he is going to have trouble, may not be able to go, and they're going to replace him with cheap employees on L-1 and H-1B visas. I mean, I was looking on Bright Future Jobs. There's some videos there, but what's going on with Indian and mainland Chinese employees in the United States? And no wonder why we have an unemployment problem. No wonder why we can't trust our systems anymore. I mean, we have folks that don't necessarily mean as well that are learning an awful lot right here. You know, of course, I have a relative.
Yeah, Dave, I got it. I got your point, and I appreciate it. I thank you for calling. I mean, on the other hand, Alan Paller, a lot of people are pointing out that the intellectual capacity that comes from abroad, if you handle it right, it can turbocharge the U.S. economy. Dave's looking in a very cold-eyed way at the potential downside. there's upside in global exchange as well. I mean, the part we're looking at here today is if that gets bled away, even when that work and study goes into American products, does it end up going away? But you've looked beyond sort of industrial espionage. I mean, there's organized crime in here as well, Alan. There's hacktivism, hacker activism in here as well.
Yes. Let's go back to the caller's nephew, though. Just there's one small silver lining in this. Because the attacks have gotten so sophisticated, there is a massive shortage of what we call top guns in security. Not the people who can talk about it and write about it, but the people who actually have the deep technical skills. And so if his nephew can pick up the beginnings of real skills in cybersecurity and in learning about networking, learning about about systems, there's a program called the U.S. Cyber Challenge that's finding these kids, almost like a big athletic program looking for Olympic teams, and getting them scholarships with the Navy, scholarships with companies, college jobs, great jobs. So there's a positive side to the security thing, security issue, which is a bunch of technology capable kids are finding wonderful ways of using their skills
if
and knowledge.
If they can pursue that sophisticated education. What about the other groups that are active in this new sort of mushrooming breach of cybersecurity?
So there are those three. There's as Jim Lewis says, the military is the greatest, that the internet was God's gift to spies. So that's the big one. International espionage is the major area. And because the People's Liberation Army in China has an economic mission as well as a military mission, it uses the same techniques it uses in military spying for commercial spying. That's part of the background behind what Scott's talking about. But China's only one of 100 nations that does this. And China's simply the noisiest. So if we over-focus on China, we're wrong. But let me take the other two groups. Mm-hmm. Organized crime, it makes money several ways. It makes money with all those spam attacks, selling things people don't necessarily want. But they also make money through extortion. So they'll steal all the medical records from a hospital, and then they'll tell the hospital if the hospital doesn't want those medical records exposed on the internet, they have to pay $150,000 or $200,000 in extortion. They also make money doing denial of service attacks, where they'll tell an online bank, if you don't pay us extortion, we will take out your site for a week. So that's a big area.
Is that rare or common?
Oh, it's enormously common. And the reason you don't hear about it is the money is paid so you won't hear about it. Because if a bank doesn't pay, then it becomes public that they can't protect their systems, and then the trust of their customers would go down. So all the money is paid to keep it quiet. Probably somewhere between 700 and 2,000 organizations have already paid extortion.
And do so regularly, you mean? This is kind of the squeeze is on? Is this like a monthly, the VIG down at the corner? I don't know where.
In certain industries, it is that. The entire online gambling industry continuously pays the extortion people, but pays the extorters. But that's a business that's under siege for a lot of reasons, because it's illegal in the United States. So, but that's the only industry I know where they're paying regularly. I think the others are one-of-a-kind types of things that don't happen.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the latest wave of cyber attacks and the Pentagon's new finding that a cyber attack can be an act of war. Alan Paller is with us from Washington. Scott Borg is here from the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit. Tom's calling from Windsor, Connecticut. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm still a little confused with this whole issue. I'll take the example of the Iranian centrifuge situation. Mm-hmm. If you had a mainframe program in-house, and even our power plants, why would you even connect to the internet and then nobody could get into your computer system?
Well, let me pick it up. Let's pick that one up right there, if I may, Tom. I remember some of this. It got very, very subtle indeed. But Alan Paller, presumably they didn't just let the whole thing hang out online waiting for somebody to come by and ding it. I mean, this got very subtle. There was talk of this being introduced through manufactured hardware, as I recall, Alan.
The actual attack in Iran used a consultant whose machine was connected to the internet, and his machine was infected. His files that he was going to take into the centrifuges machines were infected. So he carried the infection into the centrifuges, and he infected it. Very
sophisticated. Not over the World Wide Web, but actually walking in and sitting there in the facility.
So it was World Wide Web to his computer.
Mm-hmm, right.
But his computer carried it over what's called the air gap. But I thought the caller's question about why are they connecting the systems to the internet was a very good one, because it takes a lot of work to find that one consultant who can be infected and carry it in. And the reason they connect is that the business people want to know what's going on in the inside the plant. So they want continuous data so that they can manage the plant. And the easiest way to do that is to have the computers that are inside the plant feed that data out of the plant into the management systems. But when you do that, because all of the internet communication is two-way, you enable communications to go back the other way. There's actually a fascinating technology called diodes that lets the communication go only one way. And the head of New Brunswick Power says he sleeps well at night because the data only goes out of his engineering or his production systems and not into it. So we have technology we're not implementing that can help make that one-way communication.
Scott, could that be economical for businesses to use overall, or would it just bust the economics of most businesses to have to, you know, not be as directly connected to the World Wide Web?
So most businesses could reduce the internet connections to their actual operations hugely, or make it very indirect. So that is an opportunity to improve security greatly. But there's always a way to get malicious instructions into those systems. Everything has to be updated and upgraded and have things loaded into it and have data moved in and out. There is no system where the data only flows one direction. There are always devices that need to be plugged in, and that always provides attack tools. That provides attack avenues. And there's no need to identify a particular agent and have that agent carry in the malicious code, the malware. You can merely infect some system that the people who are going to be dealing with your target system are going to be plugged into. It's hard to convey to people who haven't been dealing with this field just how extraordinarily easy it is to get malware into systems and how many avenues there are for doing it.
Alan, we talked about nation states engaged in this. You say 100 or more. Talked about organized crime and the notion of them sort of siphoning off regular extortion money from businesses to leave them alone, effectively. And then we come to sort of activist hackers, hackers with a political bent, hacktivists, it's been called online. What's their role in all this, Alan?
They were the earliest players. Back in the late 90s, Janet Reno, the Attorney General of the United States, had her picture changed to Adolf Hitler, and the Department of Justice changed to the Department of Injustice in the first federal web hacking. It was funny. A lot of the public thought of it as like Spider-Man, somebody cool doing strange things, and the press lionized a lot of the people who were able to do that. After a while, it got less funny, especially when the attackers went after the press themselves. It's very common now, though, and those early attacks were because somebody was angry at someone else. What's happening now is that the sophistication that we saw in organized crime is leaking into the hacktivists. So their attacks aren't nearly as sophisticated as the others we've been talking about, but they're much more sophisticated, so they're more able to break into sites that used to be pretty well protected.
So is their work malign? Is it ambiguous? Is it positive? I mean, we heard of hacktivists kind of getting involved in Tunisia, North Africa, you know, hacktivists who were going after the computer systems of repressive governments and helping democracy movements get up off the ground. How do you judge the impact of hacktivism, Helen?
Where you stand is where you sit. Mm. I think the Palestinians and the Israelis do hacking against each other, the Chinese and the people in Taiwan hack each other whenever tensions rise. Whenever we do something, when the plane was downed, the spy plane was downed in China, huge amounts of Chinese hacking against the United States. It just depends on which side of the argument you're on.
Let's go to John in Boston. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad that you guys are talking about the hacktivists and that general movement, but I'm kind of disconcerted that you haven't mentioned the group Anonymous, which is one of the biggest players in this whole arena right now.
Absolutely.
And they're interesting because they're a collective. They aren't a centralized organization. They don't act as one group. They act as a group of singular people with their own agenda. But they are white hats. They are acting in the common good and not trying to do any harm.
They went after, what, remind us lately, they went after banks and what's been on their agenda, John?
Lately, I think what the last big one was against Louis Vuitton, actually, because they were pursuing copyright infringement against an artist who had portrayed a starving African child wearing a Louis Vuitton bag in one of her pieces. And so they went after the company and did a DDoS attack on Louis Vuitton's site. I believe that was one of the most recent ones.
So, John, let me ask you sympathize with the kind of agenda that Anonymous has followed in its political, you know, online activism, its hacking. What if it was a group whose politics you didn't agree with?
Well, the truth is that anybody that has access to the Internet has access to the materials to commit a DDoS attack, and there's not much you can do to stop it because of the way it's distributed across many, many computers, that there's no centralized place necessarily that's easily found. There's not much you can do about it. But the thing is that the people in charge, it's kind of like in the Revolutionary War where you have British soldiers marching step and file, and then you have the American soldiers using some early guerrilla warfare, where it's much similar to that, where you have, you know, kind of the slow plodding machinery of government right now can't really stand up to this guerrilla type warfare. And they just don't know how to accept it.
And we see where you're positioning it, and it's in a pretty positive light. I guess the companies who get hit don't like it. But if they're standing up for your values, it can look pretty darn good. Scott Borg, what do you make of the hacktivist element in all this?
So I actually have a lot of sympathy for a lot of the things that Operation Anonymous does and has done. And in fact, most people would if we were to go through the list of things they've done.
Remind us of a couple more.
So one of the most important things that they've done is to support the revolutionary movements in the Arab world, to attack the governments, the old regimes when they're trying to be repressive, to help supply better communication channels to the protesters and so on. Mm-hmm. The problem with this is that it's essentially mob rule. And mobs can be very good in revolutions. Mobs can do good things. But mobs can also do really bad things. And we have a lot of things that are in danger of getting rolling here in a lot of different parts of the world that are not going to have good consequences as a result of this.
And it all depends, as you put it, where the mob goes. I mean, but it doesn't look that way when you like what they're up to. Joe in Hartford, Connecticut. Joe, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing? I got a question. If they're able to hack into Google and the Pentagon, what are the chances of them hacking into the nuclear defense system and setting off one of these nuclear warheads, even as it sits in a bunker or something? If they're able to do all this other stuff, these hacktivists, could they potentially do that?
No.
Let us pick that up. I mean, we'll look at it. And, Joe, I appreciate your call. Alan, first to you. I mean, we're looking here. This is Congressman Ed Markey, Democrat in Massachusetts, saying at this recent hearing, we know there are many, many PhDs inside al-Qaeda. They are very technically sophisticated. I mean, never mind anybody else's agenda, but, you know, what about somebody who wanted to wreak damage? Start with nuclear plants and, I guess, back off from there in terms of severity. What kind of access to really critical infrastructure do you think is possible, Alan?
Well, al-Qaeda has been running schools for cyber attackers for over a decade, and their schools are pretty darn good. The Indonesian head of al-Qaeda Imam Samudra actually wrote a chapter on how to do hacking in his autobiography. It's a big part of the Al-Qaeda mission. They end many of them end speeches with statements that say, study the computer along with the Quran. This is how we'll bring America and its cronies to their knees. So that group as a potential attack group is big as a potential. They can't do the bombs have enough separation that the techniques that we have any of us have heard about wouldn't work. But the nuclear power plants are not as well protected as people think they ought to be. That's an area where we have to do more. And the National Board of Information Security Examiners, which is sort of the top authority on what it takes to be an effective security person, is actually doing a project to make sure that with the Energy Department, to make sure that the people in those nuclear power plants and that have the skills necessary to set up the defenses and maintain them effectively.
Scott, what about infrastructure vulnerability? You know, nuclear weapons right on across the board. Where do you see the greatest vulnerabilities there?
So the organization I run actually investigates these things. We put people on the ground into these facilities, and we figure out what kind of cyber attacks are possible and what aren't. And we discover that a lot of the things that are being talked about in the news and that people worry about are just extraordinarily hard to do. They're not going to happen. Nobody's going to launch nuclear weapons with a cyber attack, for instance. However, there are other attacks that are quite possible. The scariest one of all, to me, is the one that Alan Paller already mentioned, which is an attack on power generators using a tool like Stuxnet. Because that tool can be launched in quantity, because you can take an attack tool and generate huge numbers of copies of it, you could potentially attack many, many generators at once. You could physically destroy possibly a couple of hundred generators simultaneously. If you do that, the effect is just devastating on the economy. If you turn off electricity for 3 or 4 days, it costs very little because we can manage 3 or 4 days. We can manage long weekends harm.
Would that
if you turn off, if you turn off electricity for 8 to 10 days, everything shuts down. We just stop functioning as an economy.
Would that require the resources of a nation state, or would that be within the grasp of Al-Qaeda?
So right now it would require a nation state. The danger is that some years down the line, as other groups catch up and as expertise diffuses, that groups like Al-Qaeda will become capable of that sort of thing. I'm not very worried about Al-Qaeda right now, by the way. It's one of the groups that we are able to monitor in various ways. And partly by luck and partly by intention, we basically killed and captured all of the leading Al-Qaeda figures who were expert in computers or who were advocates of cyber attacks. So we actually haven't seen any sign of serious cyber attack activity on the part of Al-Qaeda since about 2008. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, they actually tried a number of things and were quite active. They certainly stole many millions of dollars using cyber attacks to finance their operations.
Scott, how do we back off of this limb? I mean, with this report of the new Pentagon framework out there, looking at equivalency and cyber attacks as acts of war, here comes this quote from somebody, you know, unnamed military official, if you shut down our power grid, maybe we will put a missile down one of your smokestacks. I mean, this gets into real war. And you're saying, yes, cyber attacks have their own costs and they're very substantial. How do you back off of this? How do you get out of this dynamic? If there's the payoff you described just economically in stealing, if everybody wants to be out there, maybe the Pentagon too now, you know, planting potential worms and bugs and probes and you name it, how do we back out of this? Is there a way, Scott?
So one of the things we need to do is to make cyber attacks part of everybody's planning. We need people to be taking account of the possibility of cyber attacks all the time. Very often the way to deal with one of these dangers is not to pile on more cybersecurity, but to change the way we do business, to alter our operations in ways that will make them less vulnerable. There are a lot of opportunities there. We also could rearrange the way we run some of our markets. We could do some relatively small things economically that would help markets to deliver better cybersecurity, which is something they are not doing right now. So there are a number of ways we can just adjust the way we do business to reduce this problem. The one thing that's not going to work is to look for one big magic solution, to ask the federal government to come up with some big anti-cyber shield, the way we talked about anti-missile shields that will protect us all.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to happen.
Hey, Alan, are we moving at least out of an age of denial? Is that part of what all this recent flurry indicates?
I think so, and I think there's actually a good future here. We fixed the automobile, the many people dying of in automobile accidents, not just by telling people to drive more safely, but by fixing the roads and fixing the cars, and that's what we have to do in the internet. We have to build a safer internet alongside of the existing internet. I think we're making some progress on that. I'm looking forward to that progress.
Wow, and do it in the midst of what a kind of undeclared war here. At some level, it sounds like, almost all the time. Alan Paller at the SANS Institute for Computer Security Training, joining us from Washington. Alan, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome, Tom.
And Scott Borg at the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit in Hanover, New Hampshire. Scott, thank you as well.
Thank you so much for your coverage of this subject. Thank you.
This is On Point.